Greetings and salutations. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski, and we are all about restoration ecology in the Anthropocene. How do we slow down, stop, and turn around the level of habitat degradation and species loss that we are experiencing at this very moment in this, our fair world? Much to talk about this week, of course, with regard, there's no end to the complexity and intensity of what it takes to do restoration work in these our days. It's May. It's actually still, and we've got another week of May weather. And I'm blown away. I am experiencing close to 90 degrees Fahrenheit today. These are restoration shows are pre-recorded. Usually I record them on a Thursday evening. It was almost 90 degrees today in May. My poppies shriveled away. Their petals, their beautiful red, blazing red petals just withered under the excruciating heat, which is abnormal for this time of year here where I live. Maybe elsewhere it's normal. But it's, you know, it's another one of those things that engenders questions in my mind, related to climate, related to everything we do as a species, and I mean we in terms of the entire global population. Where is this going? You know, and we've had a declaration of drought in the county here, and this doesn't help it. Now, hopefully, they're predicting rain this weekend and a high of 60. But these radical changes in temperature and humidity levels and all of that stresses every living thing. So hopefully much of the natural world will adapt and acclimate to the changes coming up before us. But it brings to mind for me, when we talk about restoration work and all the various and sundry aspects of it, whether it's in the ocean, whether it's in the estuary, whether it's on mountain slopes or in prairies or whatever, each scenario is unique. And, you know, a lot of times, we as a species have to see things in order to be impressed by them. And yet at the same time, seeing is not always a real grasp of the situation. We can look out at, let's say, a beaver pond. And we look at that beaver pond, it's huge, it's, you know, they vary in size, but they can be big, they can include many acres. And we assume, wow, that's a lot of water right there. Well, we're not even looking at a fragment of the amount of water that's being stored by this species in a watershed. Because what's happening is recharging aquifers, it's charging the floodplain, it's charging the riparian zone. And the water we see is not all the water that's being stored. Well, by a like token, and looking at the flip side of this, we can talk about dams, man-made dams, and the dynamics associated with them. You know, we're doing the COVID thing still. I'm being very careful. I wear a mask. I'm not ashamed to wear a mask. I've been to town probably 5 times since this whole stay-at-home thing has been in activated in the state of Oregon, at least. And when I go out, I wear a mask. I don't mind. And I keep my hands, you know, away from my face. I do all the things right. Not for myself only, but for everyone I come into contact with. In spite of the fact that where I live, there have been zero cases of COVID-19 recorded. To me, it's just a matter of common sense. Anyway, getting back on track about the visuals and how do we evaluate what we're looking at? Specifically, I went down a rabbit hole again this week on YouTube related to dams and all the dams that have been built and the many, 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 literally thousands of dams that have been taken out, most of them east of the Mississippi River. And I went in and started looking at why dams were built and how they were built. And it blows my mind to know that there were a lot of well-intended people that built dams. And human ingenuity was a big factor in that. I'm not against human ingenuity. I have hope that it will be utilized in a proper fashion. But like back east, in those ancient mountains, the Smokies and the Appalachians and the ecosystems east and west of that, dams were built for mill grists and for sawmills, for sawing lumber. Nobody even thought about the repercussions of their dam building. There, I cannot even enumerate the many dams that were built purely for the purpose of dissipating toxic chemicals that were being dumped into a river system. There were dams that were built just to make sure that the chemicals that were being dumped into the river were mixing with the river's water enough to dilute it enough to make its passage out into the ocean relatively safe. Think about that. I mean, some smart guy said, hey, we can't just dump these chemicals. The solution to pollution is dilution. We got to dilute it. Let's build a dam and it'll mix. It'll create a scouring effect. And it'll dilute these chemicals long enough for us to be able to get it from point A out into the ocean without doing a lot of damage. Of course, there's limited success related to that. But the point is, there was a dam. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of dams built for that purpose. And I've said before on the show that there were dams built just to prevent the salmon from migrating upstream, because people were concerned when the salmon migrated upstream, spawned out and died, that they were polluting the water, quote unquote. Totally oblivious of the fact that those nutrients coming from the ocean were a quintessential component to the health and well-being of the entire ecosystem, and that that process had been going on for thousands and thousands of years. But the point I'm making here is that our thought processes, why our decision-making processes, are so frail and so inadequate. And then when you build a dam, or, you know, I can envision historical societies going, oh no, don't take the dam out. Don't take the dam out. It's been there 100 years. It's a archaeological site. totally oblivious of the impact of that dam, especially back on the East Coast. It's phenomenal, the amount of dams that have been taken out on the East Coast. And even though there have been that many dams removed, I mean, in the thousands, there are multiple thousands yet that remain. Dam removal is so damn expensive. Far more expensive than what it costs to build the dam. Especially back in the day, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they built dams in total disregard of the pollution that was going into the river system when these dams were being built. Most of the time, there was an insensitivity to ecosystem function on an aquatic and a terrestrial level. It's amazing to me how profoundly ignorant we were of ecosystem function when our forebears built these dams. Yeah, it was phenomenal. There was Joe the Baker, who had his grist mill on the river, and he built a dam and he diverted the water, and he had this amazing ingenuity and genius understanding of physical processes. And the next thing you know, the river was doing all his work. Instead of having an ox or a couple of mules walking around, perpetually turning a grist mill, the water did it. The hydrological force did it. And they thought, wow, this is a cool trick. Oblivious of what that dam was doing to the fish runs, to the salmon runs, to the wildlife, to the ecosystem in general. And to this day, one of the most difficult things to do is to have a dam removed. I mean, you would think it's so common sense to restore river systems that we have crippled for 100+ years. You would think that it's a no-brainer to just let's clean it out. Let's change the way this thing goes. Let's divide some kind of some way to divert some of the water so that we can maintain our irrigation and yet not kill all the salmon or the lamprey. Let's talk some more about it, because I think, especially regionally here, dam removal is going to be a hot topic. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. We'll talk some more about this on the other side of the break. I think you're going to hear some interesting things. See you in a bit. Is over. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. We're talking about dam removal, and even on a deeper level, we're not just talking about dam removal. We're talking about the whole notion of evaluating the impact of our human intervention into the natural world based on our own visual assessment of the impact of our actions. What I want to use as an example is the San Clemente Dam. Now, back in the day, this was the largest dam removal project that the state of California had had. The San Clemente Dam was built to mitigate flood events. It was built to provide a consistent level of water supply to San Clemente, California, and irrigation, all those good things. And so when it was originally constructed, it was 106 feet tall. It actually blocked 25 miles of spawning habitat, steelhead spawning habitat, winter and summer steelhead spawning habitat in California, in that particular river system, the San Clemente River. But man, they had this fantastic idea. Hey, we're going to build this dam, and when we get done with it, we're going to be able to sequester 1,400 acre feet of water. We're going to be water secure for a long, long time. So up the dam went. Next thing you know, fish were dying off. It was, you know, the same old story. Same old, same old. The aquatic habitat above the dam was no longer functioning like it did for thousands of years. And over time, that dam no longer functioned like it was supposed to. When you looked at the reservoir behind the dam, it was phenomenal. You said, wow, this is a big lake. And when it was first built and functioning, it was a big, deep lake. But over time, over the course of, you know, 100 years or so, instead of that 1,400 acre feet of water, that's square acres, cubic acres, I mean, it went from 1,400 down to 70. The dam accumulated sediment. There were, over the course of time, over the course of when the dam was built, early 1900s, 100 years later, the dam is retaining 70 acre feet of water. The rest of it is sediment. All of a sudden, not just purely on the basis of ecological function, but purely on the basis of geologists and other disciplines looking at the dam, engineers looking at the dam, and looking at the potential for an earthquake, and they're going, folks, we have a major catastrophe in the making here. And I don't mind talking about this because this very week, a couple of dams blew out and wiped out private holdings downriver out back east. But here the San Clemente Dam was supposed to be holding all this water back. Think of it. It went from 1,400 acre feet of water down to 70 acre feet of water over the course of 100 years. And here was this monolithic structure made of concrete, rebarred to the bejeebies. Totally nothing but arterial sclerosis as far as the natural world is concerned. Clogged arteries. And yet, if you were to look at the surface area of the reservoir, you say, oh, what a fantastic lake. No, the water was very, very shallow. And once the Corps of Engineers and other careful political leaders began to evaluate the potential for a major disaster to address this not so earthquake friendly dam, it would have just, if we had a major quake right there on the San Clemente, which it was prone to, I mean, it would be a giant gravel slurry that would grind anything in its path to bits. And so they began to evaluate this dam. They began to say, well, hey, yeah, it looks pretty, but it's actually full of mud, silt, gravel, alluvial material, sand. And it's actually, over the course of 100 years, become very unstable. It can easily crack, break, and release, you know, the engineers that evaluated it also acknowledged that it wouldn't necessarily take an earthquake to loose this material behind the dam, but even a major flood event could do it. And there had been enough lawsuits in the state as a result of mismanaged or dysfunctional dams. And they evaluated it on a multiplicity of levels. They said, well, what about if we just build a dam onto the dam, reinforce it so that it would be earthquake proof? The cost was formidable. It was formidable. And the citizenry below the dam were going like, well, what guarantees can you give us? Can we sue you if this doesn't work? Their life savings, their entire livelihood, was in their investment in their property was at stake. It was in jeopardy. And they thought, well, let's do it this way. Let's do it that way. In the end, what needed to be done was that dam needed to be removed. It was not cheap. It took a lot of time. Actually, the whole project, evaluating the dam, assessing the situation, took 10 years. Think about it. If it wasn't for the fact there had been a drought season, you know, who knows what they were spared. There had been a major flood event, it could have taken the whole works out. And my point here is that the visual was, wow, there's this big reservoir. And the reality was, is that it was very shallow water. And a slurry of alluvial material below that shallow water, enough to wipe out everything below it on its way out to the ocean. And so in the end, after 10 years of hemming and hawing and wrangling with politicians and holding the people that actually owned the property and owned the dam responsible, I mean, all of that, lawyers, I mean, it's complicated. It's no, you know, simple task. In the end, everybody agreed. It was a collaborative effort. There were state agencies. There were NGOs, there were private landowners, and everybody got together and came to one mind on this. And they said, you know what, we need to remove this dam. The beauty of it is that once the dam was removed, the Carmel River was flowing free, and the Steelhead had access to 25 miles of spawning habitat. Access to spawning habitat that they had not had for over 100 years, or close to 100 years. And that story, that whole visual concept is not unique to the San Clemente Dam and the San Clemente River. We've got situations like that all over the country still. I remember growing up in Philadelphia. We had the Allegheny River, we had the Susquehanna River, all big tributaries that were flowing into the Delaware. And right downtown Philly, you could walk along the Susquehanna and you could see the dams that were built. And it was obvious looking at them that they had no real function anymore. They were just there and a pain for somebody to have to deal with having to take them out. And the thing is, these tributaries were pretty large. The Delaware is a big river, and the tributaries are very substantial. And you could go up those tributaries and the tributaries to the tributaries, and there were dams everywhere. Grist mills, diversions, just multiplicity of reasons why these dams were built and no longer needed and still there. It's fortunate for us that organizations, and don't get me wrong, I'm not signing off on any particular NGO, but, you know, the Nature Conservancy, American Rivers, Pacific Rivers, East Coast Rivers, these organizations are the river keepers of East and West Coast and mid-United States, people that found a niche in relationship to people of like minds that said, hey, let's fix this. They got involved. They started sinking money into the mix. The federal government got involved. The state government got involved. The local municipalities got involved. Private landowners got involved. Federal agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service. I mean, it's complicated. But everybody contributed something to the mix. If it wasn't from, on one level, just purely passion about doing what's right, and on the other level, governmental and nonprofit entities that had enough money to make it happen. Let's talk some more about that on the other side of the break. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. We'll see you in a little bit.
Roseburg's independent radio, 99.7 KQUA.
99.7 KQUA LP Roseburg, a community service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua Watersheds and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. More information at umpquawatersheds.org and on Facebook.
About restoration ecology again. We're dealing with dams. I was, you know, when I got started going down this YouTube rabbit hole related to dam removal on the East Coast, I learned so much. I was impressed with the resilience of the natural world. You know, back east, they have what they call feeder species. Herring, sardines, different, depending on the East Coast, West Coast, small fish that spawn in freshwater, migrate out into the ocean, which are the species, you know, the big fish eat the little fish. You go up the food chain. And herring, shad, all these different fish that had utilized these river systems for thousands of years and were now completely blocked off. I'm talking about thousands and thousands of miles of river systems that were no longer sustaining ecological function as it had evolved in these ecosystems from time immemorial. And all of a sudden, we just go in, we decide, hey, you know what? We're going to block this. We're going to use it. We're going to take this hydrological power, and we're going to save our back. I'm going to set up a grist mill, and all my farmer neighbors who don't have the time or energy to grind their grains are going to come here for a small fee or a reasonable fee, get their grain ground to flour, and go home. It was a survival thing. And I get that. And I get that the pressures of life make us do things. But at the same time, there was this extreme level of ignorance about how things work and how things should work. We were so mesmerized by the gears and wheels that were being moved by the energy of the river that we didn't understand and we didn't fully grasp the importance of the rest of the things that the river was doing. And folks, we're still doing that. Fortunately, and listen, I don't know why I'm so apologetic about this stuff. I'm not trying to say that we should be going back to the hunter-gatherer societies. I just don't see that happening. It's not practical. God bless the people that do it. There are individuals that are going like, I'm not just going back to the land. I'm going back to the old ways. Far and few between, but more power to you. But in reality, we are farmers. We do agriculture. And we need water. And our society, our populations are increasing, and the demand for water, high, clear, cool quantities of water, is only growing. And now what we've got to do is I know people personally who grew up in Western Oregon and who were able to just stick their head in a stream and drink the water without fear of toxic exposure to pesticides, to high low sediment loads from clear cutting. People that are alive today that are, you know, my age and who are decrying where we're at right now. And it's the same true in this, 1492, Columbus came to the United States. And then from there until the 1700s, things really began to change. Ecosystems were changed on the East Coast. Dams were built everywhere. Beaver were trapped out of ecosystems. The natural ecosystem engineers that mitigated floodwaters and those types of things. And don't get me wrong, I'm not oblivious of the fact that the natural world at its own pleasure can at any given time douse us with, you know, something like a 500-year flood event where nature says, you know what, I'm going to clear the system out and start over here. I mean, that happens. And honestly, I don't care how many dams you build. You're not going to prevent that. But my point here is that we changed everything and we were oblivious of the impact of that change. What I love about the work that's being done both on the East Coast and the West Coast, not just the United States, but Canada and Europe. I mean, people are waking up to this stuff. And the thing that I find so encouraging, like back east, all of a sudden, dam removal's taking place, and all of a sudden the herring are flowing up into the river system again. They still have that drive. They still have that instinct to go to their natal primary ecosystem function. It's in their DNA. And I hope that it's in our DNA. An epigenetic process. There's something inside of us that says, you know what, we need to fix this. And I am grateful to those people that are dedicated to making that good stuff happen. It takes so much money, special equipment, biodegradable, non-toxic hydraulics in the machines. You can't just drive, you know, a machine that's leaking petrochemicals all over the place. It's expensive. But you know what? It's worth it. It's worth it. It's worth fixing the things we have broken. It's worth restoring those processes in nature which made nature so fantastically mystifying and life-supporting. Yeah, it's worth it. Is there enough money to go around? No. Is there opposition to this kind of work? Absolutely. More than I even want to fess up to, lest I get too discouraged. When you have an economic interest that is to your advantage, it supersedes logic based on, you know, sound science and even common sense. It's just how we are. It's how we're wired. We derive our security from things that are synthetic. We mutually agree that this is how the system's going to work. And anything that is going to influence that segment of the system that I'm relying on to pay my bills and feed my family, et cetera, you know, we're biased. We're biased against fixing stuff. We're even more biased to be willing to have individuals invest in the kind of work that needs to be done. Tax dollars, whatever. Some PhD student needs to go out and evaluate the value of ecosystem function and the adverse impact of those disrupting ecosystem infrastructures that we have created. And even then, will people believe it? Eh, leave it alone. It's been there 100 years, not hurting anything. Oh, yes, it is. And the mind-blowing thing is the forgiveness of the natural world. Especially in the like those dams back east, when they take them out and all of a sudden the herring are heading up into those river systems to spawn. After 100 years, they still want to do it. They still know that they're supposed to do it. The original concept here at the show was to recognize that, hey, what we think we see may not be what we're actually thinking it is. I mean, the San Clemente Dam. Instead of storing 1,400 acre feet of water, it was now storing 2.5 million cubic yards of sediment. 2.5 million cubic yards of sediment. And all that gravel and all that alluvial material, which had been flowing out of that river, recharging the estuary, recharging the sand on the beaches and all those little critters and big critters that were dependent on all that alluvial material constantly moving down the river. All of a sudden, it wasn't happening anymore. And that immediately began to eliminate populations of species. We still do it to a lesser or greater degree. We're still doing these actions that, you know, we're not addressing fully the impact of what we're doing. And oh my gosh, as soon as, you know, somebody makes a proposal, oh, we're going to build a dam here. And as soon as somebody comes up and says, but wait a minute, you're going to kill the Tennessee darter, you know, this minnow, and that's not found anywhere else in the world. Forget it. It's a meaningless thing. It has no value. That isn't true. It existed where it did, not by happen chance. And all of the resistance, all of the crazy resistance. I mentioned last week in the show that we were making a request to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. On June 12th, we're going to testify and ask for the cessation of trapping and hunting of beaver on federal lands by the public. Now, we're not eliminating, you know, management tools that the agencies want to use. We're just saying, hey, we need this water. And this critter, you know, does that. It's what they do. That's their thing. That's their niche in the creation, is to retain water. And you would think it's a no-brainer. But not so. There's opposition welling up from all corners everywhere. Let's talk some more about the San Clemente and all these things about seeing, is it really believing? This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. We'll see you in a bit. talking about restoration work and we're talking about the importance. You know, I'm not complaining that the importance of gathering data. I'm not complaining that the San Clemente took 10 years, although I wish it was, you know, streamlined a little more. But a lot of that was just human hubris and opposition. But it had to be evaluated. People had to be, you know, people had to be persuaded based on the truth of what the situation was in order for that final decision to be made. And it was not clear cut. People didn't say, well, let's just remove the dam. No, there were a multiplicity of options that were considered. People, you know, what about the people that need water to irrigate? Well, the dam wasn't holding water. It was holding a slurry of alluvial material. 150 feet of gravel that one little shake, rattle, and roll or a major flood event would have pushed and stressed that concrete to make the dam burst. And we hear stories about it all the time. Of course, we're so information overloaded that nowadays we forget a lot. I mean, you have a dam blowout and 3 months later, we're thinking about another thing that had gone down and we forget about that. But the people whose, you know, profession, their discipline that they are educated in, know this stuff, and they think about it, and they go, okay, it's my job to save lives, limb, and property by making sure these dams don't blow out. And they said, okay, well, can we excavate all this gravel and silt out of here? It would have been so expensive, it's not funny. $2.5 million cubic yards. Carefully excavated out, it would require the river to be rerouted. It just was not practical. And when people finally sat down and reason prevailed, hallelujah. Reason prevailed, and they said, all right, here are our options. This is what this method's going to cost. Here's what this method's going to cost. Here's what this option is going to cost. And in the end, albeit expensive, dam removal was the most practical way to deal with stuff. And I think of the Snake River dams that are suffering from the same thing. I'm thinking about the Klamath River dams and dam systems all up and down the coast that people are, you know, look, I get it. When you have your alfalfa field and it needs water and somebody's coming to you saying, well, you're taking too much water when you know you need more. And you're killing this fish, they go, well, what's more important, me or the fish? And we go into these evaluations of the value of things. And again, a big part of why it's such a slog to get this stuff done, not just because it's, you know, expensive, but because our vision and our consciousness of the world we live in is so limited. I'm not begrudging anybody. Listen, people have, farmers especially, they get up early, they work hard all day, and they go to bed late when the season is there for that. And their whole psyche is built around, you know, understanding what is best for the field that they're managing. And when you approach them with the whole notion that, hey, there are fishing boats out there at the coast that are not catching fish because you're utilizing your irrigation right. You know, the first impulse is, hey, tell them to sell their boat. And then you have, that's one aspect of it. And that's the rationale that people think from. But there's another aspect of it. And I mentioned this last week too. I know people that are telling me that the restraints that are being placed on irrigation and this and that and the other thing are just a hoax. Some kind of hoax to gain control. How I earnestly desire that as we as a civilization progress, that we begin to evaluate more and more reason based on sound information, and that we cultivate ways to support one another in the process of doing this. Look, if somebody's four generations been relying on a dam that exists and the dam is a minuscule fraction of its functionality of what it was when it was built, I think it's a social responsibility for us to help those people. I don't think we ought to just cut them off and say, hey, life's tough. Well, life is tough when you make mistakes. You know, the natural world can be very unforgiving in that way. But as a society, I think we ought to accommodate each other. When you start taking away or impacting a person's livelihood, undermining their security, What kind of reaction you think you're going to get? We have to be real, and so we have to make provision for those things, for us as a species too. And if we're really fouling the works up, then we need to correct it. It's those areas in which our human behavior is intransigent, where we refuse to move, even though we know it's right. That's the bugaboo right there. And I'm sad to say there's more of it than I ever would have realized prior to my long-standing commitment to restoration work. And there's whole communities built around the idea that politicize restoration ecology and make it sound like some kind of conspiracy. And from my perspective, it isn't. I'm just saying, hey, the reason we are, you know, the society we are is because we're taking advantage of millennia of ecological trust that the natural world has stored in itself. And we're bringing it to the brink of bankruptcy in many, many areas. And that's why you have species disappearing. And it does matter. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard. I was talking to someone just today. And, you know, the discussion, we went round for round about this. My life choices brought me to close proximity to the land and to the natural world. And I had the advantage of living in a time when information was mega available. And I took advantage of it. And so I tried to be as careful as I could be in my decision making with regard of my life being integrated close to the land and close to the wild, trying to minimize the adverse impact that I would have. and I will not say that it was nil. I wish I could say that. You know, how many times have I accidentally, when I'm changing the oil on a vehicle, did I spill some of it onto the ground? That couldn't be good. You know, I'm not sitting here postulating that anybody is pure as the driven snow when it comes to our interaction with the natural world. But I can say that I did all that I could do, apart from my human frailty, to do what was right and reasonable with regard to the natural world and my relationship to it. And I think that there are a lot of people like that. That said, you can go drive down the highway and see all the trash that people just throw out, you know, beer cans and pop cans and plastic bags and everything else along the highway. I'm not so naive to think that everybody in the human race cares. But I think that we as a society can care and should care. And we should cultivate and reward caring. We should facilitate those systems of education and human interaction that reward our capacity to make changes when they need to be made, and to support those segments of our society, the people in our society that are jeopardized when we have to make a change. And to a degree, we did that, like back in the day when logging got cut way, way, way back. You know, the federal government came in and said, we're going to offer educational programs for people to change their vocations. And a lot of people took advantage of them. And I'm glad they did. And I'm glad that we as a society were willing to do it, to take tax dollars and do that. The San Clemente Dam was nothing more than a dangerous gravel pit. An accident waiting to happen. And most of our dams are that. And the people that want to keep the dams ought to be held responsible for the aftermath of any danger that could be spawned from those infrastructures. And if they don't want to be held responsible, then I say, hey, let's make a way. Let's provide a way to help people. Make the paradigm shifts toward restoration work that need to be made. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski, and I'm glad, I'm very, very glad that San Clemente Dam is gone.